Over the past 7 years, Zimbabwe has gone from being a democracy with a growing economy to being a country with runaway inflation, food shortages, and government crackdowns. Joining me now for a look at Zimbabwe's problems are Isabella Mutambanadzo, the Zimbabwe Program Director for the Open Society Initiative, Southern Africa, and Princeton Lyman. He is an adjunct senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a co-editor of Beyond Humanitarianism, What You Need to Know About Africa and Why It Matters, to be published next month by the Council on Foreign Relations Press. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to this month's Backstory. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thanks for having us for the program.
Now, Zimbabwe's official inflation rate is 4,500%, although there are independent estimates of 9,000%. And the International Monetary Fund has said it could rise to 100,000% by the end of the year. That boggles the mind. What does it mean in real terms, Isabella?
Well, thank you very much for making the time to speak about Zimbabwe on your program. What it means really is that if you are able to get to the supermarket, because your first challenge is finding the transport to get you to the supermarket, so if you are able to make the journey from your home to a supermarket, when you get to the supermarket, the goods on which inflation calculation are based are often not on the supermarket shelf. So you are right in questioning the validity of the official inflation rate as it is set by government at 4,500%. So desperate is the government to contain inflation that it announced last month that it would stop publishing inflation data on Zimbabwe. So once you've made the journey to the supermarket, you cannot find the goods, or the value, the price of the goods change as you move from the supermarket shelf to the counter to pay for the goods. So you pick up a piece of bread, let me say, at a shelf in the supermarket. By the time you get to the till to pay for it, to ring it up, the value has changed.
Minute by minute, the inflation is going up. You are in South Africa right now. Have you witnessed this situation in neighboring Zimbabwe?
Absolutely. I arrived into South Africa from Harare yesterday, so it's something that I'm coming familiar with. You know, at the moment, really, the trouble is not only the inflation figures, but even getting your hands on cash, on Zimbabwean currency, is such a challenge. You can go to the bank and fail to find local money. It's one thing to fail to find foreign exchange, but it's another when you have a dearth of your own currency in your society.
Princeton, what kinds of solutions has President Robert Mugabe suggested to fix this situation?
Well, I'm afraid that he has come up with very few solutions to the problem. What he did most recently was to demand that retailers lower their prices by 50%. And what that did was to drive a lot of the goods right out of the market.
Into the black market, you mean?
Into a black market or simply being hoarded. And then there was an arrest of a lot of businessmen, et cetera. But that kind of policy simply doesn't work.
Well, don't you drive businesses out of business when you tell people to cut their prices in half? They may very well have paid more for the merchandise in the first place.
Exactly. And so you now see critical shortages of basic commodities on the market, whether it's milk or bread or meat, because people won't produce and sell for a price that's arbitrarily set by the government. It's just an example of the kind of autocratic kind of approach that Mugabe takes to problems such as this.
So you said there are arrests. How many arrests are we talking about in connection with this clampdown?
At least hundreds were arrested but then released. I mean, it became a really impossible policy to follow. So most recently now they've allowed some of the prices to go back up again in a kind of agreement with some of the vendors, simply to get the goods back on the market.
My guests are Princeton Lyman and Isabella Mutambanadzo. We're talking about the current situation in Zimbabwe with runaway inflation and other issues, which we will discuss in just a moment. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Isabella, hasn't President Mugabe moved to nationalize the country's mines and have all companies operating in the country under Zimbabwean control. What does that mean? First of all, what about the mining? What kind of mining is done in Zimbabwe?
Well, at the moment, there's a big flurry towards looking at diamond mines because we've had a recent find in the country of diamond mines. So that's one of the minerals that we're looking at. But Zimbabwe has a rich base of natural resources. We have gold, we have silver, and we have a whole range of minerals, granite, for example. The main concern here is that the nationalization also feeds into what we're seeing as the influence of China on Africa. And we're finding that a lot of the natural resources are seeping out of the country into the Chinese market through what is unofficially called our Look East policy. This policy doesn't actually exist on paper. You can't find it in any government document. It's really the rhetoric of the ruling elite of our country, struggling to find new markets in the face of what they see as hostile markets in the global north. So this is what really is the impetus of indigenizing the mines. It's to try and find a new trade partner.
Well, if the trade is occurring, whether it's to the east or with the more traditional trading partners, and the country is so rich in natural resources, why is there such a problem? Is somebody getting rich at the expense of everybody else?
Yeah, well, when you look at the figures in real terms and when you track where the minerals are going, the worrying trend is that there's an invisibilization of the resources. So what actually comes out of the earth and what eventually officially hits the market, somewhere along the line, there's a seepage that we're not able to account for. And we're very concerned about a plundering of Zimbabwe's natural resources that we will not recover from as citizens, and that for the long term, we will be paying a price for unclear, untransparent, and corrupt business practice in this area of natural resource extraction.
Does this mean that Robert Mugabe is personally enriching himself? He's a rather old man. Does he need any more money?
That is not usually the criteria by which people enrich themselves, unfortunately. No, he doesn't need the money personally, but he does need the money to keep the military loyal to him and to keep a number of the party people loyal to him. So it's a system by which the resources of the country go to shore up the regime.
So that's the way he has maintained support from the people who matter, but he hasn't always paid the police or the military. Why do they remain loyal?
Well, I think that there's two things, and Isabel may want to comment further, but I think the upper levels of these security forces are involved in the same system that he is and his top supporters are. So there is support at the top. There's also unclear what the alternatives are. The opposition does not have yet a lot of credibility, certainly within the security forces. So there's no, at least we haven't seen any open serious dissension within the security forces so far.
Yeah, let me be frank about what I believe is the reason that ZANU-PF as a party retains power is because there's a bludgeoning of the citizenship in Zimbabwe. Every week, no less than 500 citizens are arrested and imprisoned arbitrarily for protesting, for trying to reach out for and claim their human rights. And what we've seen as a response of the state is not only official police and military response, but we have a whole layer of quasi-militaristic responses through such things as the youth militia, for example, which is accountable only to the office of the president. And this is why we have an ability of the security forces in Zimbabwe to be able to do what they do. Many of them are not the professionalized police or the professionalized, well-trained army. They are actually quasi-militia groups that have been set up by the ruling party to rule through terror and through brutality.
Do you see a direct link between these human rights violations and the deterioration of the economy?
I would say yes, because if citizens live in fear, if citizens are not able to be confident of the political climate, then you have a crisis that is clearly linked to the economic situation. If you do not have confidence that your climate will enable you to go to work and to earn a respectable income, then there is going to be a crisis. And I would say absolutely the violence we see meted out against, and the latest victims have been people in the business sector, shakes any kind of investor confidence in an economy.
Princeton, you wanted to add to that.
Just two other aspects to this, and they are related to government policy. One was the way in which the Mugabe government carried out its so-called land reform, which was to suddenly dispossess most of the white large commercial farmers, but handing out the land in large part to either political cronies or to people who weren't prepared or supported to produce. And the result has been that Zimbabwe has gone from a surplus food country to one heavily dependent on food aid. The other factor, and it's directly related to the political and human rights situation, is that millions of Zimbabweans have left, unable to stay in the country. And the way some Zimbabweans survive right now is that these people who have gone abroad send money to actually send goods across the border from South Africa and elsewhere to their families and relatives to keep them sustained.
Because, Isabella said earlier, and as we've seen in newspaper photographs, the grocery stores are pretty much empty, and I was wondering how people were getting food, or are people starving?
Yeah, I would say that we have to look really at the figures that the humanitarian agencies are giving us, expecting some 4 million people in Zimbabwe requiring some sort of food aid and food support. And yes, I would say we have a major challenge with nutrition. I would also add that we have a major challenge with productivity. So because of the policies of the government, where on the one hand you give people land and then you control the value of soya beans, producers are not bringing crops to market. And so it's a vicious cycle of things gone wrong in a society and of things being malgoverned by a government that really is very desperate to win the election. And my point is that what we're seeing unfolding in Zimbabwe right now is the beginning of the political campaign of ZANU-PF trying to trump up support for the elections in 2008, in March of 2008. And that also is something that we have to watch, how a government now is going to use food, as we've seen in the past, as a way to influence and sway the vote, particularly the vote of people in isolated and marginalized communities that are food scarce.
We have to take a little break, and we'll come back to that and related matters with my guest, Isabella Matambanadzo, the Zimbabwe Program Director for the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa, and Princeton Lyman, Adjunct Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and co-editor of a book that's going to be published next month by the Council on Foreign Relations Press called Beyond Humanitarianism, What You Need to Know About Africa and Why It Matters. Stay with us. And we are back with Princeton Lyman and Isabella Matambanadzo talking about Zimbabwe on today's Backstory. Princeton, President Robert Mugabe has been in national politics since 1980. He assumed the office of president in 1987 and has been reelected twice. What sort of government did Zimbabwe have in the years after it stopped being Rhodesia?
Well, there was a long and very bloody civil war for independence, that is to overthrow the white-dominated government that had already declared itself independent from Britain. And Mugabe was a principal leader of that rebellion and was then elected president. But he very quickly moved to demolish the most serious rival party led by another major liberation figure, Joshua Nkomo, and to crush opposition in the southern part of the country, Matabeleland, and therefore very quickly absorb the opposition into a single party rule. Nevertheless, for a number of years, Parliament functioned, the courts functioned, there was a relatively free press, and as you mentioned at the outset of the program, a relatively vibrant economy. things began to turn sour when Mugabe tried to strengthen his power through changes of the constitution. Isabel, you can correct me, I think it was in the year 2000, and lost that referendum. And that set him on the direction of absolutely more, steadily more brutal rule in order to shore up his support and to crush the growing opposition movement that had begun to take place.
So he tried to institute changes constitutionally. That didn't work. So then he tried it through demagoguery?
Demagoguery, intimidation, and finally suppression of the independent judiciary, closing down the independent press, and then violently suppressing opposition. The opposition that has grown up in recent years, the Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, is both an urban-based, labor-based opposition, also strong support in Matabele land. They have struggled to get a place in the electoral system against an enormous amount of oppression, and he's determined to crush that in virtually every way possible.
Isabella, was that also when he decided to adopt a new land policy in 2000?
I must say, while I agree with Princeton, I would actually take the repression in Zimbabwe back to the 1980s, to as early as 1983, when we started to hear that something was happening in Matabele land to discipline what were being referred to in the local language as dissidents. And 20 years ago, in 1997, a report was put together about the Matabeleland massacres. The report is available publicly as Gukuraundi. And as many as 20,000 people were murdered in that period. And now when ZANU-PF speaks about this, they say it was a moment of madness. So they respond and say, we did this, but it was a moment of madness. And I would say that as early as 1983, we were seeing the signs of a tendency towards repression and brutality by the ruling party. But unfortunately, because everything else was looking so good, the education indicators were looking marvelous when we looked comparatively in the region. The healthcare indicators were looking marvelous on a development scale. Things were working. So that glory was able in some way to make the repression seem a bit invisible. But now we're living full throttle, as you've already discussed, in a monstrous environment where the repression cuts across even people within the ruling party. And this is what is very interesting about the tactics that Robert Mugabe has chosen. They put fear into people within his own system of governance.
Like Stalin did earlier. But weren't there already signs in the 1990s when Zimbabwe got involved in the war, the Democratic Republic of Congo? That became a drain on the economy, didn't it?
Absolutely. And it's a horror because we have, as a country, to account for some of the crimes that have been committed, particularly on the bodies of women and girls in the Democratic Republic of the Congo by military forces, not only from Zimbabwe, but from other parts of Africa. And when we have to account for that, it's going to be quite shocking what we are going to discover. The DRC was definitely a contributing factor. And I'm glad you point out 1997, because it was also the year that Mr. Mugabe made unauthorized budget expenditure towards veterans of the liberation struggle who were aggrieved at never having received some kind of compensation for their contribution to the liberation struggle. And this also contributed to economic demise.
But he waited until 2000 to adopt this new land policy. Why did he take so long? And Princeton, you want to answer that?
I think that for a long time, President Mugabe used the land issue as an important electoral issue. But between elections, he really didn't do much on land reform.
Was most of the land owned by whites?
The whites dominated, without question, the commercial land situation in Zimbabwe. And there was a real need, politically, socially, for land reform. But Mugabe Mugabe used it more as a political vehicle and at the same time did not take action against the white farmers and did not take up various offers from the World Bank and others to work through a different kind of land reform.
Now, under Idi Amin, the land seizures led to a terrible economic crisis. Didn't Mugabe see that? And why did he think that he started instituting these land seizures or supporting them?
Well, it was in part a way to shore up his political appeal, particularly among his own ethnic group, the Shona, who are very much crowded onto traditional lands, and that was a result of the colonial period. So the hunger for land is clearly there, and it's a very important appeal to Mugabe's supporters to give out land and take it away from the white-dominated agricultural sector. The problem is the way it was done was to undermine and destroy the agricultural sector rather than to carry it out in a way that would really allow people to become much more self-sustaining farmers.
Do the land seizures continue to this day? Is land still mostly controlled by the former white colonialists?
No, there are very few. There are still a few white farmers there, but many of them have left. They've gone to other countries or gone to the city or simply left Africa. There are a few left, and he made some feints toward inviting some back, but the conditions are so uncertain that I don't think that will happen.
Isabella, earlier this month, Mugabe approved a surveillance law that allows the interception of mail, email, and phone calls. Has this kind of surveillance been used to target activists?
Absolutely. When you are in Zimbabwe, you can really tell that your communications is quite open. And the activists are struggling to find places where they can operate securely and safely. But I just want to say also, to do with the issue around the land reform, the current situation is that, as Princeton has outlined, that the land reform business is not concluded. So what Mr. Mugabe has created is a situation where we have an ongoing crisis about a genuine devolution of land. And what's happening now is that those who received smaller scale farms, those who don't have political muscle perhaps, are under threat from those who do have political muscle and economic ability to buy them off land that they've gained. So now we have another layer to add to the human rights violations we saw with the land seizures. We now have a layer to add where there's uncertainty among some of those who've genuinely gained some land rights, some farming and property rights, who had nothing before, being uncertain about exactly where they stand in the current dispensation, where there is a tendency to want to buy huge tracts of land by those who have political clout and economic muscle.
So have the white colonialists who used to control the fates of millions of black people just been replaced by a Mugabe elite who are doing the same thing?
To some extent, yes. But there are also some white farmers in Zimbabwe who remain, whose huge land tracts have been untouched because they have the right political connections. They are connected to the ruling party. And so their territory, as they call it, has remained safe because they pay political patronage.
My guests are Isabella Matambanadzo, the Zimbabwe Program Director for the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa, and Princeton Lyman, Adjunct Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking about Zimbabwe on today's Backstory. And Lyman, in March of this year, the arrest and beating of opposition party leader Morgan Tsvangirai made headlines around the world. Is the Movement for Democratic Change the major opposition party at this point?
It is the major opposition party, but it suffers from a lot of disadvantages. One is the outright suppression of the ability to even meet and hold rallies, and the beating that you mentioned of Tsvangirai and his other lieutenants was a shocking public demonstration of the kinds of things that Isabel has been talking about. Unfortunately, the opposition doesn't get traction and support from outside, that is the neighboring countries, and we need to talk about the role of the neighboring countries, don't really accord the opposition the kind of respect perhaps that it needs. And it is struggling, and it's divided internally as to how much it should participate in elections that they feel are very largely rigged. And this is a constant source of disagreement within the opposition itself.
Isabella, you're in South Africa now. Is there much discussion about why Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, has been so reluctant to get involved in Zimbabwe's problems?
South Africa defines its approach to the Zimbabwean crisis as needing what's called, what they refer to as, quiet diplomacy. However, when you take a critical look at this, it's actually a kind of diplomacy that's screaming and loud in favor of the regime of Robert Mugabe. In the U.S., where you can track this because that's where you are, you can see that Ambassador Khumalo of the South African mission has on no less than three occasions blocked a motion to vote on Zimbabwe at the UN, at the commission, which is now the council. And this is not a kind of quiet diplomacy. In our view, it's actually a kind of diplomacy that favors the status quo. And Princeton is very right. When you look at what's happening in Zimbabwe, it reflects the challenges we face in the emergence of credible political opposition movements that are really people-based and that are internal. The language is that the opposition is a puppet of the West and of imperialists. Yet many people who were founding members of the opposition are Zimbabweans who felt from a working-class base that the rights of workers were not being protected. And so what you have with the response of South Africa is an attempt to moderate some kind of shared government between the MDC and ZANU-PF. There is a kind of tone that you get out of the South African leadership that seems to say the opposition is not good enough. Yet that's not what South Africa's role should be in Zimbabwe's policy. It should be to enable Zimbabweans to have genuine and credible elections to choose the leaders of our choice, not for South Africans to determine who can lead us.
Does Robert Mugabe still have cachet as a hero of the anti-colonial past?
He does.
Go ahead, Princeton.
Well, I think he does with certain parts of the population, certain parts of the African intellectual population, and he gets some support from Angola and Namibia, who feel that same connection to an anti-colonial past. But
they must see that this country is falling apart, descending into chaos, and that can with so many people leaving. And also with economies interconnected, it could really mean a certain amount of disaster for all the neighbors of Zimbabwe.
The neighbors who are closest feel it. South Africa certainly feels it with at least 3 million Zimbabweans. Botswana has complained, Zambia, Tanzania. But Angola and Namibia, who are much farther away and have a different history, looked at it differently. I would just add to what Isabel said was that I think Thabo Mbeki's view is that what he would like to see is a ZANU succession to Robert Mugabe, at best with the MDC playing a minor role. I think that also reflects a sort of a bias toward the ruling party in Zimbabwe rather than the opposition.
Now, we're going to have an election in 2008. Robert Mugabe will be 85 years old. Do we have any idea of who his chosen successor is, or are we just talking totally in terms of the party, ZANU-PF?
You see, this is where the dilemma is, because it should not be up to Robert Mugabe to choose the successor of a political party. And so what we get as an example of this whole debate on who will succeed Robert Mugabe is a clear example of how all the institutions of governance and government in our society have really been made incredibly fragile. The business of electing the successor to the current president of Zimbabwe belongs to the people of Zimbabwe, not to the current president. So this fiefdom mentality is something that we're really struggling with in our societies.
It's assumed that the elections will be rigged, isn't it?
Well, I think it would be very surprising if any government led by Robert Mugabe would permit a fully free and fair election.
Is there anything approximating a free press in Zimbabwe these days, Isabella?
Absolutely not. I would say that actually at the moment, journalists in Zimbabwe, working in Zimbabwe and trying to operate out of Zimbabwe, are among the ones most at risk across the world. If you look at what happened with the journalist who managed to smuggle out the footage of the March 11 torture, he was killed in very mysterious circumstances. Very recently, Abel Mutsakani, the editor of an online outlet operating in Johannesburg, was shot in strange circumstances. All this happened after Zimbabwe's Minister of Justice, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs had made some very dubious remarks at the African Commission on Human and People's Rights about how these online media are lying to the world and need to be disciplined. So we need to consider the risks that anyone who is trying to generate and capture information about the current state of affairs in Zimbabwe faces.
And we have an estimated 3 million people leaving the country, South Africa refusing to build any refugee camps to receive the Zimbabweans who have crossed the border. It seems to me that we're going to see a lot more chaos before we see any improvement. And that's unfortunate, but we have to leave it there. My great thanks to both of you, Isabella Mutombenadzo, the Zimbabwe Program Director for the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa, Princeton Lyman, adjunct senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and co-editor of Beyond Humanitarianism from Council on Foreign Relations Press. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Len.
On tomorrow's show, a Washington Post panel looks at the subject of America's black men and their place in the national experience. Then a professor of psychiatry describes her own experiences as a chronic paranoid schizophrenic. Plus, Ben Ehrenreich explains how he has been inspired by Homer's Odyssey to write his first novel. And our own word maven Patricia T. O'Connor takes your calls on the uses and abuses of the English language. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Kim Gittleson, Paula Crossfield, Tom Lisi, Alexander Ben-Aim, and Scott Goldberg. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.